Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the August 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. I'm Meera Senthilingam and joining me this month are Andrew Turley, Josh Haljigo and Patrick Walter to talk about cells being used as lasers, a new cool way to store hydrogen, using nanoparticles to target tumours, and how a little disorder can be a good thing.
What the new paradigm says is that function can occur at a much earlier stage, and disorder proteins, before they fold, or if they don't fold at all, so intrinsically disordered proteins, can have function without folding.
Julie Foreman-Kay will be revealing the high level of disorder found in our proteins and how nature has made the most of this later in the show, when we also hear about using rollerball pens to make electronics, how a dinosaur's smile is helping solve a paleontological mystery, and a new insight into the field of appetite control. So plenty to look forward to in this month's Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And to kick things off, a new way to make electronics using nothing but pen and paper. Andrew?
Right, so what's happened here is a group at the University of Illinois, led by Jennifer Lewis, have taken a regular store-bought rollerball pen and filled it up with silver nanoparticles sort of suspended in a fluid and then been able to draw electronics straight onto surfaces. Some of the surfaces are paper, some of them fabric, just using the pen writing in the same way as if you were writing an essay or something like that.
So, but what's the benefit of doing this? So things like printed electronics or electronic ink's been used, say, in printing technologies and so on to make, say, transistors or other things like that. So what's useful about it being in a ballpoint pen?
So there's nothing specific about a ballpoint pen. It's all just about exploring all the possibilities. What people are interested in are cheap and disposable electronics, the sorts of things you could just do on your desktop at home. They call it desktop manufacturing. And this shows that that there's a lot of flexibility there. There's some very, very basic things used in this particular instance.
So what have they actually been able to make? So what have they used the ballpoint pen for?
They've done a variety of things, one of which was to make an LED display. So establishing the LEDs on the paper or the surface and then just connecting them up by drawing with the pen. They then showed that they could bend and flex this surface to make a ball, just demonstrating that there's lots of different things you can do with this approach.
So how would you summarise then the main kind of benefits of having it in this format?
It's just a very low-cost option. It's a very flexible, basic option. It's showing that these printed electronics have the potential to be very robust, and also it's very cheap and disposable. That's a key factor for anyone looking to commercialise technology later on.
Now, moving away from the future of electronic ink and back to our past, back to the dinosaurs and fossils, which are providing new insight into whether dinosaurs were warm or cold-blooded, Patrick.
Yes, there's been a long-running debate over whether dinosaurs are hot or cold-blooded, so whether they're able to regulate their temperatures themselves, or whether that just like reptiles, like lizards, they would rely on the sun to warm them up. So what Rob Eagle's team at Caltech and the US have done is they've been looking at fossils from the Diplodocus family, three different sauropods, and they've looked at the teeth to try and determine just whether they were hot or cold-blooded.
So what did they actually look at then with these different kind of samples of these teeth fossils?
Right, so they drilled into the teeth and they took some samples and they broke them up to look at the carbon-13 and oxygen-18 isotopes found in the teeth. And the reason they did this is because apatite, the mineral that teeth is made out of, these two isotopes are laid down in different amounts and different clumps according to the temperature that is present.
And so what have they been able to find out then? What actual new insight has been provided doing this?
Right, so what they found is that some large dinosaurs actually had temperatures which are actually had body temperatures which are comparable to that of modern day mammals, about 36 to 38 degrees. So obviously dinosaurs were pretty warm, but there's other possible reasons for this other than just that they were warm-blooded. So dinosaurs might have been warm-blooded due to a phenomenon known as gigantothermy. So this is where you have such a large surface area that you lose your heat much, much slower. So species like leatherback turtles rely on this to stay warm. So some models put these dinosaurs at having temperatures in excess of 40 degrees C. But this new discovery could mean that these dinosaurs had physiological adaptations to actually wick away some of the heat. So this means that their necks, their tails, could be a way of losing excess heat in the way that certain marsupials like kangaroos do by running blood close to the surface of their skin.
So has this really helped solve the fact that they weren't necessarily cold-blooded, but there's still the problem of whether they're warm-blooded or if they're gigantotherms?
Yeah, I mean, basically what they run into here is a problem that they can't distinguish between whether the dinosaurs were warm-blooded or whether it was down to gigantothermy. So this is going to mean more investigation, sifting through the fossil records, looking at sizes and various other analyses to try and work out quite what's happening here.
But still one step further on this long road of mystery. Thank you, Patrick. Now, we meet a scientist who's discovered a great deal of disorder going on in nature. But it's an organised form of disorder, providing function through this disorder, all in the form of disordered proteins. Explaining more is Julie Foreman-Kay.
A disordered protein is best understood in contrast to a folded protein. So a folded protein with stable, ordered structure can be thought of as having pretty much a single lowest energy ground state, and they have specific interactions with each other. And a disordered protein is a highly heterogeneous ensemble of different conformational states that may transiently populate helical or extended structure over different segments. So you have a wide variety of structures which are sampled and interconverting dynamically in solution. So disordered proteins have interesting preferential structure which relates to their properties, but they're not ordered.
So this is really moving away from conventional thoughts on proteins in terms of them only really having a function kind of once they've folded and got this final structure. But what you're saying here is that earlier on in their formation, they've actually got function there too.
So the traditional paradigm is that there's a discrete line between biological information and biological function. And, you know, the traditional paradigm said that, you know, you start with DNA, which is information, and you go to RNA, which is information, and you go to the unfolded polypeptide, which is being translated on the ribosome, which is information. And then this magic thing occurs where the protein folds, and then you have function. And what the new paradigm says is that function can occur at a much earlier stage, and certainly RNA can be catalytic. You know, you have functional RNA enzymes. So RNA is not just information, it is also function. And disordered proteins, before they fold, or if they don't fold at all, so intrinsically disordered proteins, can have function without folding. People think that, oh, they're this new kind of protein, so there's a sense that there aren't that many of them. But in fact, bioinformatics analyses of the human proteome suggests that about half of proteins, of human proteins, have significant stretches of disorder. And maybe about 20% of human proteins are fully disordered.
So having kind of identified really that proteins and disordered proteins can function at this earlier stage, I guess, could you give an example of some disordered proteins, say, in our bodies or elsewhere in the environment, and how the disordered protein functions there?
One very nice example of a disordered protein is the protein that's involved in elasticity in our bodies. There is a protein called elastin.
So this is something that's quite important biologically in our bodies. What role do disordered proteins play here in the function of, say, elastin and providing, say, elasticity in our skin and so on?
In this particular case, what you have is an ability to maintain transient fluctuating interactions while the protein is stretched. And yet when the protein is let go, that it can shrink down and become more compact. So it's the disordered protein itself that has that elastic property. It's a physical chemical property of entropy, basically, that drives elasticity in disordered proteins. But I think most of the functional properties of other disordered proteins have to do with their very large surface area that they present for protein interactions.
Why do you think that they've evolved, I guess, in this way? So what are the benefits of having this kind of spectrum of function amongst proteins?
I basically think that physical chemistry dictates that you're going to have that continuum, and nature is just going to exploit what's there. But I think the benefit for us in expanding our understanding of what's there is that we can now have a much more thorough appreciation of many aspects that have, really led to trying to understand evolution. I think there's a lot of principles in terms of understanding post-translational modifications where enzymes have to come in and have access to these proteins. And if they're buried in the middle of a hydrophobic core of a protein, it's not going to happen. But now it's much easier to understand that most of these sites of post-translational modification are exposed because they're disordered. And so, I think we can understand a lot more things, and we can bring to bear our appreciation of polymer chemistry principles and electrostatics, which play a much more dominant role in disordered proteins than they do in folded proteins. And there's a whole field opening up now.
How are you hoping that we can use this information? So what are perhaps some of the applications, having understood them?
Well, once you understand how biological processes can be regulated by these protein interactions, you can design ways to fix things when they're broken. For instance, many cancer proteins and many, many diseases have an involvement of disordered proteins on different levels. And if you can understand how disordered proteins bind, then you can design drugs more effectively. And so if we understand what the physics is, the physical chemistry, then we could better design compounds that could be used as more effective therapeutics for these disordered, highly dynamic interactions.
So hopefully providing more specificity for our drug design. That was Julie Foreman-Kay from the University of Toronto. And now from manipulating proteins to manipulating cells and turning them into lasers. Tell me more, Josh.
So basically, here is some research which has been conducted by a guy called Suk-Yun Hun and his postdoc Malte Gaither from Harvard Medical School. And to commemorate the kind of 50th anniversary of the laser being discovered, they basically thought, hey, let's get a cell and try and turn it into a laser.
And so how did they set about doing this?
So what they did is they took the green fluorescent protein, or rather they took a plasmid, which is a little circle of DNA which encodes for this particular protein. And what they did was they put that into a cell and got the cell to manufacture that protein inside of it. And then what they could do was they basically used that living cell as the gain medium for a laser. So that involves basically taking two mirrors, putting the cell in between them, and then kind of irradiating it with blue light. And then the cells, the green fluorescent protein, will kind of amplify that light and spit it out as a kind of sort of amplified laser. So it's kind of very narrow bandwidth light, very high energy, and in one direction.
So I guess to set the scene a little bit for this, how do lasers, I guess, generally work, and then how is it then being used or applied here?
Normally, so I talked a little bit about this kind of gain medium. So the difference here really is that the gain medium is a living thing. In most lasers, they would use like a crystal or a special dye which has certain energy kind of wavelengths, well, energy levels rather, sorry. And basically what these guys identified was that this particular protein has some of the same characteristics as those kind of things.
So what is it hoped that this could be useful for? So they did it to commemorate, I guess, the laser, but could it have any applications now that they've identified this possibility?
Yeah, they did it kind of almost as a gimmick, but actually, like, I think it's it's got some quite cool applications. So one of the things that they're sort of thinking about is helping to improve the resolution of kind of biological imaging. So when you shine kind of radiation onto a person to try and see what's going on, like in a MRI scan or something, so often you get quite kind of blurry images, and that's because there's a problem with the radiation penetrating into the body. But if you could actually have cells which acted as lasers, that problem could be kind of got around. But it's the first time this ever been done with something living, so it's quite amazing in that respect.
Moving from lasers to hydrogen now, more specifically storing hydrogen, something that's been quite a challenge for scientists for years now, really. But now a simple solution, I guess, to this could be available, Andrew.
Right, so hydrogen is of great interest for transport. It's hoped that we can use it because once processed, you only get water out the end. And the materials they've looked at for storing hydrogen, if you're going to use it in a vehicle, have not been ideal so far. So what these guys have done is investigated whether or not you might use something very, very simple, something very cool, which is ice.
So how have they set about seeing if this is possible?
Right, so this is all theoretical work, modelling that they've done on computers. And what they found is that while they were looking at the different phase transitions of ice, they found that as it melts through one of its phase transitions, certain structures develop that they might be able to fit hydrogen inside. And then you could carry it around as ice. And then as the ice melts fully, you get the hydrogen back out and be able to burn that, or probably more likely use it in a fuel cell.
Through the modelling, how much hydrogen was it possible to store? So what are some of the figures?
Right, so they've managed to store 3.8% hydrogen by weight, which is not a bad figure. They've also been able to load that hydrogen at 150 Kelvin, which is quite a good temperature. It's something like minus 123 degrees C. But there are a lot of practical considerations at the moment, one of them being the ice would have to be crushed in some way to reveal the underlying structure. The surface doesn't exhibit quite the same structure that you would need for this storage. Also, you need a certain amount of gear for carrying it around. But having said that, the ice is better than a lot of other traditional materials or materials that have been investigated previously, like MOFs, metal organic frameworks, or carbon nanotubes, in that it doesn't need high pressures to load the hydrogen, and it doesn't need high temperatures then to release it later. So there's some very promising aspects to this.
You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Meera Senthilingam. And still to come, a new step in the technology of smell-o-vision. First, though, how a good understanding of food emulsions and the way they interact with the enzymes in our body during digestion can help in the fight against obesity. Peter Wild looks into the interface between the oil and water in such emulsions and explains just how they're broken down in our bodies.
It's quite a complicated process. There are several different types of lipid digesting enzymes. They're all called lipases. There's one in the mouth, which doesn't do an awful lot. There's a gastric lipase in the stomach, which begins the whole lipid digestion process. So it breaks down the fatty molecules into its component parts, so they're ready for digestion. But once the emulsion, the fat, gets into the small intestine, then you have the secretion of the pancreatic lipases, which are more complicated. Because the enzyme has to adsorb to the surface of the fat to be able to break down the fat itself, there may be other things on the surface of the fat which stops it doing that. So the liver secretes detergent-like molecules called bile salts, which strip the surface of the fat and allow the enzymes to adsorb and to break down the fat. More than 90% of the fats are actually absorbed in the duodenum. And so we're trying to understand how the bile salts adsorb to the interface, how the enzymes adsorb to the interface to break down the fatty molecules. And we're trying to understand that process at the interface so we could control it and then maybe delay the digestion for a more slow release of lipids or promote the uptake of the more beneficial lipid compounds like the omega-3 fatty acids and fat-soluble vitamins, those sorts of things.
So what have you been able to see so far? So what are some of the mechanisms that you've been able to get an insight into?
One is really the action of the bile salts and the lipase. We took a typical lipid which coats the fat, lecithin. It's found in eggs and soybeans and all sorts of vegetables and fruits. That's quite surface active and it will coat the surface of the fat. This forms a very condensed film on the surface. When you add the bile salts, we actually got these really nice images which show that the bile salts break down this condensed phase into different domains of more condensed and more expanded areas. And then we added the lipase, and we found that the lipase actually adsorbed into the expanded areas only. They didn't really adsorb into the condensed phases. That allowed us to understand that the bile salts were basically breaking down that interface and to allow the lipase to adsorb. And then we're looking at a different type of lipid. They're called galactolipids, and they're found in cereals and leaves and plants, all sorts of fruit and vegetables. And they've got quite a big head group which sticks out into the water, and they can pack very tightly onto the surface of the fat. And we found that they can resist the adsorption of the bile salts, so the bile salts didn't really have any effect on the interface. The enzyme process and the breakdown of the fat was much slower when we use galactolipids. So we're using that now as a basis to go forward for some human trials to hopefully feed some model foods and see if that affects their lipid digestion and their appetite.
And so I guess with this knowledge that you've managed to get so far, so you've mentioned that appetite control could be one application. And so this, I mean, given current situations with regard to obesity levels and so on, is it hoped that this knowledge could be used in order to, say, develop certain types of food or in order to, as you say, control appetite to therefore prevent people overeating? Or what are the main kind of applications that you're hoping to use this information for?
Well, yes, that's more or less it. There's a lot of interest in promoting satiety and controlling appetite as a healthy lifestyle. The majority of the obesity problem that we have at the moment is by people consistently overeating small amounts throughout their life. So if you look at the data, people are effectively getting fatter, getting bigger with age, and the age groups with the largest body mass index is around sort of 50 to 60 years old. And so if we can encourage people just to reduce their energy intake by, you know, only a few percent by controlling appetite, so it reduces snacking, reduces overeating at meals, that sort of thing, you can reduce this age-related increase in obesity.
So is it hoped then that this could be something that could be used reasonably soon when factoring, say, various foods and kind of helping people think about what they're eating and controlling their appetite?
Yes, there are already foods on the market which claim to do this sort of thing. As we learn more about those types of foods, they'll become their role in the market and the role in appetite control and weight control will become clearer. Then there are some more fundamental research projects going on, like ours, where we're trying to understand the actual mechanisms involved so we can optimise the type of food and the composition of the food to maximise this appetite control effect. And in the future, because of legislation, foods which claim to control appetite will have to provide very strong evidence that they are actually doing that in a clear, well-defined way. And so our research is hopefully contributing towards that knowledge that will provide that evidence.
Peter Wild from the Institute of Food Research. And on to nanotechnology now, with the use of tag-team nanoparticles to seek out and destroy tumours with a greater specificity than current treatments for cancer. Patrick?
So everyone's familiar with the horrible side effects of chemotherapy, the nausea, the hair loss, all the other problems that go with it. So Michael Saylor at the University of California in San Diego has come up with a way to try and reduce the amount of drugs you need to administer in the body and to try and get them into exactly the right place using these nanoparticles that communicate to each other.
So what are the nanoparticles, and I guess how were they set about communicating? What's a communication signal used?
So the nanoparticles, they divide them into two sets. They've created transmitters and they created receivers. So the transmitters work by hijacking the body's own coagulation system. So when these transmitters enter the tumour, these are tumours in mice, humanised tumours in mice, the nanoparticles cause the tumour cells to release fibrin. And this is a molecule that normally clumps together to help form a clot. That's all part of the body's recovery system. So these nanoparticles cause a massive release of fibrin, but it's kind of localised to the tumour cells. So then these other nanoparticles are receivers. These receivers are able to detect the fibrin, and they get localised to just where the fibrin's being expressed.
So they're able to communicate in this way, these two nanoparticles, but how do the first set that go out and find the tumour actually find it?
Right, well, there were two sets of transmitter nanoparticles. So there were gold nanorods that are able to localise to the tumour. Because of their size and shape, they're able to get stuck into the blood vessels of the tumour. And there's also an engineered human protein that is able to target the tumours in a similar way to the way antibodies can recognise specific antigens in cells in the blood, in these kind of things.
So these identify the tumour and they send a message out to their counterpart to come along. But how is the tumour then defeated?
Right, so when the signal's been sent out, when the receiver particles pick up onto the fibrin, they're localised to the tumour cells. So in one case, there's a liposome with a peptide attached that responds to the fibrin. And as part of that response, the peptide that is attached to the liposome gets stapled to the building clot. So once in place, the liposome can release the drug that it's been impregnated with. In this case, that's doxorubicin.
And how effective, I guess, did they find this method to be in comparison to other treatment possibilities?
The chatting nanoparticles, are much better at localising to the tumours. So compared with controls that didn't have the transmitters, these receivers accumulated 40 times more in the tumour. And their killing power, well, it's pretty good. They're able to cut the tumour volume approximately by half in 20 days compared to the controls.
So I guess a summary of the benefits are really that they can really target them, and side effects are obviously reduced as well.
Yeah, the most important thing about this dual system is that it's able to massively increase the amount of drug that is localised to the tumour. There's no wasted drug all over the body that's causing unpleasant side effects.
And from nanoparticles sniffing out cancer cells to, well, us sniffing out experiences with a new form of smell-o-vision. Josh?
Yes, that's right. Smell-o-vision is a reality. It's official. Sung-ho Jin from the University of California in San Diego has developed a new kind of polymer kind of matrix which can hold a range of different smells. And we think it could give rise to a real smell-o-vision.
But a while back, I remember smell-o-vision was an idea. It's been around for a while, but it wasn't necessarily very popular. I remember places had tried it, and I think what were the problems with it before?
I think the problems were it was just completely rubbish. So in previous examples, you could kind of give out one smell. And in reality, like, we experience, like, one smell, just one molecule is gonna smell really kind of fake. In reality, the smells we smell are composed of lots of different molecules. For example, like a perfume like Chanel No. 7 or whatever, will have hundreds of different molecules in it, and so we need to be able to have a complex mixture of them for it to be realistic. And they need to be coming out like all of the time as well, so not just like once or twice during the film. Otherwise, it just feels like a bit of a gimmick, I think.
So how does this new technology set about providing this great variety of smells?
Well, what they've done is they've created a polymer kind of matrix. So it's a polymer polydimethyl siloxane. So it's a clear kind of polymer, similar to what you'd use in kind of sealing up bathroom tiles, something like that. It's the same kind of chemistry that's involved. And what they've done is they've created wells in this polymer, in which they've impregnated water solutions of odour molecules, so things like alcohols, things like ammonia, kind of smelly chemicals. And so they've got a matrix of that. So there's about 10,000 different kind of wells, all with different smells in. And then they can use a kind of a clever heating system to heat up each individual well. That makes the gas expand, and then it bursts out of the little pod, and then it escapes into the atmosphere and you can smell it.
This heating process is what's going to be really controlled, say in a film or wherever it's used. This is what is going to be controlled to actually then release the smells.
That is exactly right. So this research was done in collaboration with Samsung. So I think it's very much trying to be a thing which would be in collaboration with film. So the idea would be you'd be able to buy like a little cartridge or something with your film. You'd be able to sort of have that in a little device and the heating would do, and it would take its course, and it would be programmed so that the smells would come out at sort of opportune moments during the film, basically.
A lovely technology to help transport us, say, to the countryside or a cafe during a movie. But I'm not sure I'd be quite as keen for a horror or a zombie film. But staying with you now, Josh, you've got a lovely bit of trivia connecting fishing with photosynthesis.
The answer is linked to the Nobel laureate Melvin Calvin, who was the guy who discovered photosynthesis. And he was a very serious man. He didn't have any time for pleasantries or jokes. But he had a graduate student called A.T. Wilson, who was a massive joker. And he had a bet with his departmental secretary that he could sneak in a little diagram of a man fishing into a scientific paper. So he drew this tiny little man fishing into one of the reactors that was drawn on one of their seminal papers in which they disclosed all their amazing results about photosynthesis. And Calvin would have hated this, but he never found out, he never noticed it. And actually, sadly, he died a few years ago and he never found out about it.
If people look up this paper, could we see it for ourselves?
Yes, you can. You can't actually see it on the internet, the electronic version of the paper. It's not a good enough resolution. But I actually went to the trouble of photocopying a print copy of the journal from the 1960s, and you can see that on our blog. So if you go to www.chemistryworld.org and then click on our blog, you'll be able to get onto it and see it that way.
And I'll be getting straight online to have a look at that myself. Thanks, Josh. Now, that's all we have time for this month, but do join us again in September for more of the latest news from the field of chemistry. Thanks this month to our contributors Patrick Walter, Andrew Turley and Josh Howjigo. I'm Meera Senthilingam from thenakedscientists.com. And until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.